1920 and before. You've got two villages right up there. Right up here.
Put the thing on.
Right there.
Put that map on, see?
I was right up here, these two villages, the only two villages on the island that did go. Lagoda and Pinellas. If you look on the map that Mescal did, these guys are the guys that are identified as speaking a quote Dogu language. In fact, he at times says it's a different dialect, but a different language, and he can't quite describe. And in fact, I think it's a different language. So in the old days, prayers would come from Dogu or from Waiawa. Or I think perhaps occasionally from Centaro. Sail down here, stop here, and trade with their partners there. Then traders here would sail down what's called Panawari, which is a big area down here that includes Calvados, includes a lot of these small islands down here. Includes what's called Koyagaga, or Dawson Island, which is here. Sometimes includes even Basilaki, Okata, and Sidaya. It's a very vague term. Panawari means Wari speakers, or Wari speech, or something like this. Again, all these people, the guys that Mescal identified as speaking what's called Koduwa. Or Mbikuwa, type languages. In fact, it's actually more complicated than that. But Panawari people had a lot in common with people in this part of Normandy down here. And in fact, people in this part of Normandy seem to speak languages similar to it, though they did not ever participate in the Kuma until about 1930s. Just after pacification. Calvados people, and these people down here, then were in contact with Mishima people and Sidas people, or people, for example, Debbie. So things like axe blades can come down like this, be traded from Panawari, and be traded from Panawari into the Mishima area in exchange for necklaces. And that's where necklaces came from. About 1910 to 1930, the government put a great deal of pressure on the people who were originally living up in the mountains along here, to move down to the coast. These people were originally very much of a bush-dwelling kind of people, knew nothing about canoes, knew nothing about sailing. Had no contact with the coast apparently at all, had no contact with the people up here except for warfare. And the two areas seemed to sort of fight each other periodically in sort of very vague, great kind of affairs. Under government pressure, they moved down. And beginning about 1920 until, between 1920 and 1930, so they became a district of the Kuma, which now consists of about five villages right in this area, which is about 2,000 people. The largest group of Kuma traders on the whole Normandy island at this point. And they have essentially taken over the entire trade between Normandy island and Panawari. So people in this area sail from here to this area, but more usually they just walk. And more usually they just get up one morning, take a walk down the coast, spend the night at their partner's house, and go back the next day. So that's the Normandy Kuma in its most formal sense. Then along here, you've got a series of smaller villages where individual people sometimes participate. Instead of few people along here, you've got one or two people up here. There's just a very few people in here. Again, all these guys are individuals. They simply get in their canoe or hop on a riverboat and visit their partners and come home the next day. There's very little that their trade has to do with anything within the village. That's about the sort of general outline of the Normandy Kuma.
Do you have any women in the Kuma?
Absolutely.
Is there a woman in there? Kaki?
Just a Mr. Lindau's paper indicates that there's many double and women around the coolers there are double men.
At this point, normally women participate perhaps 30% of the traders. The other thing is, at this point, these guys are actually more important traders than the people in this area. They're the only guys on all of Normandy who have big canoes that can sail on inter-island areas. They get their canoes by trading them from Kainawari and get them their stuff from Windward.
How long have those southern guys been in the system?
I suspect about 30 or 40 years. There's a real question about how they got there. And since I didn't speak their language and didn't really know much about them, all I can do is at this point kind of take the word of people I knew who said that they married people from these islands down here. And as the way Normandy marriages work, a lot of valuables move back and forth in the course of these marriages. And the idea seems to be that they must have made these marriages with the island people, receive valuables, and then kind of, what do you do with them? Well, they... Well, no, this is, the thing about Normandy people's argument is that you've got this stuff, all you can do with it is either hang on to it or trade it. And an awful lot of people actually, in fact, just simply hang on to the valuables for years and years and years.
And you mean Mwani and Bobby
and
Beku and all of that.
Beku, nose plugs, some great wooden bowls.
Mm-hmm. They don't want the Beku? They don't work into their own internal exchanges?
No, they don't use Beku. They're called Tamanich Nagu. It's quite a bit different from the Chogrins.
Could you tell us about the range of valuables, what kinds and what networks they enter?
Well, Bagi and Mwari and Ashwades move down like this. People say in the old days a great wooden bowl about so big, so deep, was carved somewhere down here. They're not really very sure. Perhaps Mr. McGrath is kind of out
there. I heard Mr.
But at any rate, they moved up in this direction and acted something like a valuer. Sometimes moved down to Dogu, sometimes not. There are also nose plugs, which is, I think you've seen them, a large, perhaps 6-inch nose plug, carved out of some kind of mollusk. Sometimes, they didn't really circulate actually as tour valuables, but moved along with them. There are stuffy bolts that add to this, but tour valuables.
But is there any notion of sort of the main thing is the armchairs for Nicholas's? Is that the same as we find up in the Trobians and in Dover?
Oh yeah, it's exactly the same valuables.
Yeah, but I mean sort of that you exchange armchairs for necklaces. That's the main principle.
As long as you're doing it within the Kuba.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The thing about it is there's other contexts outside the Kuba that many of these Kuba valuables. In other words, the valuables that Trobian is called Kuba valuables. We're also used in this area for other purposes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
And
that's
the
what
purposes
of
what?
Yeah. Marriage exchanges, mortuary exchanges, housewarming parties. There's a lot of different occasions that can be used on. And it's these occasions that are important. And this is the reason I said, the question in this area...
Does that take them outside the system? Or are they coming back in once they've done it?
Well, they may or may not. In other words, a man can receive a valuable from a partner. And give it to his wife's natural lineage. His wife's natural lineage can then either hang on to it or they can themselves put it back into the pool along their teta.
Can we go back to take that point back to Jerry? Because in terms of the Trobra, being told that there's very few small proportion of people working at Kula. Nevertheless, these kula, the bagua, in a general sense, are being used for all sorts of things. In the kula, they're being used for marriage transactions, for funerals, and so on. Are these things moving in and out of the kula system in this way, or is it only kula people who exchange these things?
No, what Carlos described goes on in woodwork, too.
And same thing on Agawa. What I was trying to ask also is, Agawa, you see, you give to an affine, comes from the man's psychic, and affine, he'll pass it on right into the cooler. Something kind of necklace comes back and goes back to you or to your kin who gave it to you, and may continue down. And you may form a loop of a cooler path that way.
No, this never developed into a cooler path.
Yeah.
And in fact, about I'll have to go into this later when I do my paper, but the valuables that enter into the village are called Kikuma valuables. And they're distinguished very, very sharply from real Kuwa valuables. Though in fact both of them can move into Kuwa. But Kikuma valuables get into the village. They may remain there for a long, long time, being exchanged between a whole series of different mental nations. When somebody dies, you have to give a valuable. You have to, even if you owe a valuable to somebody else, one of your partners, you have to pull it out of the kula, and it may leave you in debt for a long, long time, but you have to pull it out.
I've always believed there's a hole on that side of the ring, and it leaks. And it sounds exactly like what you say.
Carl,
these things, how long is a very long time of staying in this sort of internal exchange going on there?
It can be permanently.
And that there's no
way.
I mean, is there any way that they leave that area at all? I mean, not even going back to Kula, but leaving, maybe going down the south coast?
Well, it's possible, for example, for valuables to leave this area or this area and move into other parts of the island.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, I don't really know what happens to them, but people in this area don't trade very much. They like to have these things sort of like heirlooms.
Okay.
There's a guy who had a large farm called Fine, who just had it in his house for 15 years. And Kula partners from Dobu and from this area down here kept going to his house trying to get it.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it's my thing. I don't want to give it away.
Yeah.
This isn't a hole. This is where Kula slowed down.
Right.
I'm serious because the whole problem with Kula is it partly is slowness and speed.
Well,
it's
yeah.
the same patterns we've all got. You've got it in street form where it's slow.
I have to add.
There are other possibilities. I mean, firstly, like, you know, an aberrant movement from the south.
But it's a well-known thing that there's some places where people are hard in the Kula or slow in the Kula, like in the Amplex
yeah.
or the Kailuna.
Certainly, you're normally people have that perception.
No, I don't think they do. Well, these people may.
It's tied into anybody else.
The other thing I've got to add that is very important in understanding the Normandy Kula is that apparently this is based on what Lithgow says, and Rayo, you can comment if you know. Most Dobu traders and most Waiowa traders sail directly down
mm-hmm.
here,
yeah.
bypassing
mm-hmm.
Normandy entirely.
Yeah.
In addition, many of these traders who do come to Normandy sail down here, not stopping here.
Yeah, all my paths go through places like that are south, you know, most of them. I have that one path, as I mentioned, that comes to Normandy. They go through Gaboine and the other islands in what they call Rarang, which is a range of islands down. Okay. And then they go up to Dobu, and Dobu. And that's, and there will be different islands that they go to, but that's at least for my stuff.
Can you give any idea of how many shells would be in that area?
Relatively few. I think Normandy's best understood is somewhat marginal to the Kula. In other words, a Kula trip by Lavota village people to Dobu will consist of perhaps 20 or 30 people coming back with less than 30 shells.
Oh.
The kind of Trobian trips where people come back with hundreds is totally inconceivable in this area.
But what about these areas that are not cool, that sort of got stuck into this internal thing? How many shells would be in that area?
I don't think very many. I think just an occasional shell. Like I said, there are a few people, there's two men here, and there's a couple down here who themselves do Kula. But for the most part, I don't think Bagi and Mari are that important in these internal communities outside of this area and this area down here.
But once they get them, they hold on to them, I guess.
Well, they may or they may
generally.
Not.
Generally.
You see, there's a very ad hoc quality to the Kula in this area. It's not sort of rigid and formal the way it's supposed to be.
So would you answer your own question by saying these people are in the Kula because they want the arm shells for bride wealth transfers?
Yeah, that would be one possibility. It's not bride wealth though.
Or whatever.
That's one of the reasons. Another reason they give is that so fathers can give their children short necklaces.
There's an enormous hole in the entrance that people eyes appear. I don't know what because the Amplex must have had an awful lot of good valuables passing through their hands, and a lot of inferior ones too. And a lot of inferior ones went first for good enough, and Northern Furness and then, and just never came back, it just disappeared. internal ones and good enough. But we didn't seem to get the good ones that were good enough.
No.
So they were channeled down east to Dobu, presumably. And all the good ones went that way.
Well, if you kept out of the good ones, the bad ones, who would get the good ones?
I think that we're probably going to get into trouble.
Yeah.
If we go to each area and ask, where's the kula? I think I was mentioning this the other day. I think to a lot of these people, the kula is really something that other people do primarily, and we can accommodate them when they come to visit us, but we work with the valuables in a different way. And this is the way I always heard it explained to me from the Southeast perspective. And this seems to be what's going on here, that people will try to be cosmopolitan as much as they can and accommodate people and get what they can get out of it. But they know how to work with the valuables in a different way and are interested in the valuables and will get them. And when they get a woodlark visitor, like Paniati would get woodlark visitors every once in a while, but they would never go to woodlark. They didn't sail that way. And they'd say, we give them things, and we never knew what happened to the things after we gave them these things. And they always said, come and get your return, but we never could come and get our return because we were to sail there. But
they made enormous communities.
In the memory of these people, they didn't make that long trip. And here it really looks like, from the perspective of these people from the inside going out, rather than from a regional perspective, that the kula was not something that's on their mind very much.
I think maybe a better way of putting it would be that you have guys like the Trobriandes, for example, and perhaps the Dobu people, who are really thinking in terms of constructing inter-island status, inter-island thing, and spreading their names within inter-island arena. Then you have guys like Dobu people who aren't, well, do this if nothing else is around to do. If they can somehow manage to do it while satisfying all their village needs. But their primary focus is within the village.
They weren't sailors, really?
At one point they used to have the Dobu and Kripura start their farm. They did make those fortunes. But at least today, inter-island fame can only be achieved if you don't foul up your village exchanges.
Well, I'm not sure about that. You have quite a reputation down where we are.
Yeah. You know,
reputation.
What are you going to do?
We're having just mounds of stone axe blades.
Uh-huh.
Now, because of that, there was a trip by Grass Islanders once. I mean, this was, they're always doing things the way other people don't. This is just one small island that's sort of very small. And they decided that they were going to, firstly, they didn't like, pardon me, Paniata people coming down and looking off their coconuts and things like that, which they always did when they were trying to sell the canoes. So they were going to bypass the Paniata people and go straight to the source to get wood for the outrigger, which was on, and make it themselves, which was on Duau. And so what they did was to sort of, they knew a guy in Motorina who was somebody's cousin and who had some sort of land rights in Duau, you see. And that they had the idea that they'd pick up this old guy who'd always wanted to go back home for a trip anyway, and take him to Duau. And in addition, they had somehow, and nobody knows how, gotten their hands on this really enormous stone axe blade. Now, this is in Grass Island. Usually you've got a movement of stone axe blades coming down the chain and back, going up the chain, they say back. For stone axe blades, they say tobo tobo. Okay, so you've got, in this case, to sort of encourage the whole transaction, them taking this huge stone axe blade up the chain and to Duau, cutting their wood and everything, exchanging it for a shell necklace, which, you know, is very unusual to have them parting with their shell necklaces. Wait, this is one point. The fact that, there are all these, you know, you're talking about that as being a leafy area. Well, in fact, you know, you do get sort of movements that build up a little bit. It's resources, usually in the form of shell necklaces and such, which eventually get cooled out. You know, it's never cooled in, but it can be cooled out. And the other thing is that it's difficult. You're building a picture of the kula as being a northern, as you said, a northern mass phenomenon, and which it is technically speaking. I mean, if you don't consider Leao, which is what we're going to be talking about later, which is on the similar sort of lines, and but the valuables themselves, the canoes don't make it, you know, as far down south as the cabals, but the valuables, the same valuables, in fact, do, arm shells aside. So, you know, are we talking about kula as ending with the people and the canoes that transact them, or are we talking about it as the valuables in some form, in some way, extending or sort of projecting the ramifying, the kula, into these other areas?
I like what you've got in Europe and America at the same time. You've actually got two fine art objects and archaeological treasures. There are two rival sets of interests in here. There are the people who are involved in the fine art market, including the British Rail Pension Fund, who are very anxious that the whole point of our valuables is they keep on coming back into the market. This is how they establish the values of the thing. This is how they justify buying them. On the other hand, there are the owners of the controllers of museums who are all concerned all the time to take things out of the market and keep them there. So that although the same people are, there are two sets of people competing for these objects, but one set are trying to remove them from the circuit, and the other set are trying to put them back in the circuit. And there seems to be something very similar here, because the value is always established by the circulation. But there are also people who just want to have treasures that they hang on the wall.
John? Yeah, I would like to turn back to the South of Normandy in Ferguson. And I think that there could be two reasons for people to enter the kula, either to get the valuables off, but they couldn't do that permanently. Then the people the people who were in the kula wouldn't give them all the time and don't have anything back. Or they could be interested in the associated exchange of useful things. But maybe it's so that between the north and the Dobo-speaking area and the southern part of Normandy and Ferguson, there isn't very much to exchange.
Well, Normandy is a high island. It's got a 4,000-foot mountain on it, and it's very, very rich. The only thing I think they ever needed was obsidian from Dobo and pots from Mari, or pots from Lampas.
Yeah.
In other words, this area is called Kainawari, which clearly in the Kula, for much the same reason that the amplets were, they had to trade pots or dried fish or dried shellfish to get stuff to eat. They had very, very poor islands.
Mm-hmm.
They could grow very, very little food. And they themselves say that part of the reason we went on Kula trips was to bring this other stuff to trade. And even the day when Northern Duwap people, these guys, no longer actually sailed to Kainawari to do kula, the Kainawari people, particularly Wari traders themselves and a few traders from very small islands that fish a lot, sail to this area to trade their products for principally yams. So that whole trade of utilitarian objects has been entirely split off from the kula. The Kainawari people sail here to do kula, or not sail to Dobo to do kula, but they sail here enough to the west where they've always apparently traded. The other thing is, these people have always sailed to this whole area along here to trade for pots for yams, or fish for yams. So the utilitarian trade and the kula trade has been always fairly independent.
Mm-hmm. Question, Carl, do you know that from seeing those islands, or from people telling you about it?
I talked to one man from Wari, who is my uncle, I think he is.
Yeah, but there was a guy in Warai in Woodlark as a missionary. He told me that the island was very productive in terms of food, and that's the Woodlark impression of that area.
Well, which one? Why?
That all of what he's called
Kaiwari.
You know, they have plenty of food. That's
well,
like a sailor. No,
there's
a sailor.
Very, very small islands in there that small and are basically sort of sandy atoll to the few people that come. Wari itself, the descriptions I had of it, had clay, that's why they made pots. They don't really have soil.
And the same is the case with Tuktu, they had to import all their food, or most of their food. That's insane, man.
Well, one index that I have of that, that people told me is that the rituals, sagals, that people put on Woodlark, they put it on right as they harvest. Whereas the people down in Kanawari put it on in our December, which is at the planting season. The reason why you put it on then is because you can show that you do in fact have a lot of food. And nobody in Woodlark would think of putting on a big ritual in December, roughly, because they don't have enough food.
Fred, there's a problem that I don't know when they plant in this area. And there's quite a good chance that they don't plant at the same time they plant in New York. There's a 3-month planting season difference between here and there.
But like when?
Well, they plant up here in July and August. They plant down here in October.
Yeah.
Yeah, what we're talking about.
On the leeward side in July, and the windward side later.
Yeah, they associate it with wind.
Because this is a factor that I've not seen referred to in any of the papers I've read so far, which is not all of them, on this area as a whole, and that is the effect of winds and other climatic geographical influences on the pattern of movements and sailing to home. You know, we had that reference of the communications, the distribution of land communications on in this region, which I thought were very illuminating. But that's not been modified in relation to the prevailing wind and so on, as factors governing movement in canoes. I mean, if what we're talking about so far, if you like, is the leeward end, the sort of pocket at the leeward end of the trade wind belt in this area. Everything gets blown down this way, so to speak. It's not so easy to get back up to the windward end. It would be much easier to get across the area and down into it and back out.
But in a lot of the earlier literature on these islands, the first report made it perfectly clear that there were two seasons. They went one way one part of the year and the other way the other part of the year. I mean, I assume that the wind was the regular trade wind kind of cycle.
Yeah, but the point is that in these other areas, all the year round, you can go across the trade wind.
I don't think so. At least you can't go from Dobu to Dua all the year round, according to local people who've had...
Not down here, no. I was thinking more of the rest of the area, farther south and east.
Well, again, people who remembered sailors who had sailed from here to here said it too was seasonal.
Do they come down the northwest?
No,
they come down from Woodlark through Mishima on the northwest, and they return when it changes. In April.
Woodlark, Mishima, northwest.
Why don't we break for coffee now and come back in 15 minutes? Rank the classification of shell valuables.
Well, yeah, basically.
Classification of Kula shell valuables by Shirley Campbell, who spent around 18 months on Bakuta, 1976 through January of this year.
Just let me say that Versus classification is coming from Bakuta informants, and they have this idea that it's the same all the way around Massif. So when I seem to be talking, in terms of the whole Massif, I really refer referring to Bakuta.
You should actually part this assumption, whether the assumption holds if the thing is the same in one Okay, fine.
The exchange of shell valuables in Kula is a major arena for competition between men in the Massif area of Papua New Guinea. The whole realm of relationships are defined and differentiated by Kula and competitive. The system by which shell valuables are classified and ranked is an index to these relationships and an extension of competition. This paper is intended to contribute further to our understanding of the shell classification system. the criteria by which shells are placed in the categories, the ranking of these categories according to criteria well defined by certain well-defined features, the relative value in relationship between categories, and the means by which certain shells move between categories. Can you just close that in there?
I think we can have the lights, please.
While living on Barcuda Island, I had ample opportunity.
Could you take a dive under the table or something?
Yes.
I have to operate the machine. It's not automatic. I'm sorry. You could.
You
could
take
a dive. I can't.
Not well.
Do my best.
Can anybody hear me over the machine?
It's a
machine.
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
The machine is a booyah. Where is he?
That's a lot of time, Joe.
While living on Barcuda Island, I had ample opportunity to observe and participate in the handling, appraisal, and very visible appreciation of some of the finer cooler valuables. During an encounter between two potential or established cooler partners, there are noticeable differences in behavior and attitude before the shell labels are openly displayed and immediately afterwards. Before the shells are displayed in front of them, the two men are jovial. However, once the valuables are presented, the atmosphere changes to one of studied silence. The present owner sits very quietly, suddenly confronted with the reality of his imminent separation from the shell, and the accompanying uncertainty as to whether its place will be filled later. He sits quietly, mentally assessing his lines of argument concerning the shell and his relinquishing of it. Next slide. The visitor is likewise struck with silence as the cooler valuables are laid out in front of him. He is also working out his line of the argument necessary to acquire the valuables. It is during this period that the shell is visually assessed. The visitor will turn the shell in his hands, noting features which place the shell in the classification system. If the shell is a Mwadi, he will hold it for its heaviness. He will turn the shell back to him and count the number of cowrie shells across its width. He may then place the Mwadi on his mat with the shell's cut end facing him. He will inspect it thus for a long time, taking note of its circumference. When he is satisfied with his assessment, the weight and dimensions, he will look for signs of age by inspecting the restorations on the shell called kala urieri.
Pardon me, could I break in? Those white discs hanging from the armchair, what are they?
Which one? These ones here?
Yeah, no.
These ones here?
Yeah, the sick ones.
These ones?
Yeah.
Those are little cowrie shells. Real cowrie shells with the lips folded symmetrically. If, on the other hand, the visitor is assessing the quality of a vaigua, he will hold it along his arm to measure the length of the shell string. In the film that we saw yesterday, you noticed that they did that. They hold it like this to measure how long it is. He will examine closely the fineness of grinding and the thickness and dimensions of each individual shell disc. The vaigua is then held at arm's length to appreciate the color. Finally, the shell string, held between thumb and forefinger, is run through the hand to determine its most prized quality, the combined smoothness of the ground shell string. If the hand slides along the string like oil, or it slips through the hand like a very fine fishing line, it is of the highest ranking quality of vaigua. Next slide, please. According to the specific qualities of weight, circumference, width, length, and signs of age, cooler shell labels are thus judged and categorized. In this way, each shell enters the hierarchy and is converted and competitively sought after according to its position within that hierarchy. Before continuing to enumerate categorization and ranking of the cooler shell valuables, it will be helpful to identify various parts of the shells used as classification criteria. Next slide, please. The Mwadi is manufactured from the cone shell Conus vulcanitatis, one species. It is said to be the male partner in the cooler marriage.
which contrasts with Malamocs.
Yes, you have a contrast as well.
Yes.
We'll
get into male and female symbolism. It's going to be extremely
important. Yes. Where am I? The rope by which Somwari is suspended is called Kaipwesi or Utun. Utun is a more general word. Kaipwesi is the word they use for your handbags, which is a very symbolic sort of thing. They're very keen about this particular rope. And so therefore, this Kaipwesi, using it, is semantically linked to this very closeness to men, particularly just to men, as opposed to anything close to women. The cowrie shells, ovula ovum, attached to the kaipoesi are called lupukaidoga or rainbow. That's this shell here.
Egg cowrie.
How about
ovula
ovum?
Egg.
Because of the conical shape. Because of the conical shape, there are openings of unequal diameter at each end of the shell. The large diameter end is called poala, which you can see in this end. This is the end that is cut. I mean, is knocked in on the side, so it's the closed end on the actual cone shell, and the other part goes down like this. When many, as I just said, next one, please. Small cowrie shells or moire d'ogre are attached to up to 1/4 of the circumference of the poala. Those are the shells here. And this one is a very low ranking shell. As you can see, it's only got 2 shells, meaning that the darbala, or the head of this shell here, is not of a length that would accommodate more shells up to, say, here. So this shell is a very small, low ranking shell. The end of the muadi with the smaller diameter end is called the wadola or mouth. This is made by cutting the conus with punctatus, leaving a circular opening. The critical characteristic of the wadola is its circumference. The greater the circumference, the higher ranks a shell can attain. In this shell, again, you can see it's a very low ranking shell, but the mouth is very small. This would never get over 1 tan. What sort of size? The water is probably be about 2 or 3 inches. Right, can I please the next one? Thanks. By looking at the back of the wadi, the natural lip of the shell can be seen. This is called kudula or teeth. Attached to the kudula are small cowrie shells called buna kudula. The number of buna kudula that can be attached to the kudula define the width of the muadi and thus indicate attainable rank. A low-ranking shell will accommodate only 1 or 2 buna kudula, a middle-ranking shell 2 to 3, and the higher-ranking shells 4, 5, and sometimes 6. You can see on this one, this shell, again, is a low-ranking shell, can only, well, it does, in fact, get 4 across it, but because it's small that way, and it really is fairly narrow, that this would be a low-ranking shell, but you can see how they've got 4 there. Now they're just sort of stuck on to the end to make it higher ranking.
So, point out the plus from the original shell.
I understand now, I didn't know this before, that they scrape off the markings, mm-hmm. they rub it off, so that there's no markings on it at all.
Yeah.
When I first saw it, I thought, what kind of natural process is this? This is the shell losing its markings, but here you can see they can't get underneath there, so it's not
being rubbed off. That's the original surface of the original
shell.
You can see them on the shells in the box.
Hence the difficulty in defining which particular genus these shells are. There are probably varying genuses, I think. Buna kudula and muadi d'ogre are used as units of measurement for classification criteria, thereby indicating the muadi rank or potential rank. Men who have not yet seen a specific muadi will tentatively rank it by asking about the number of muadi d'ogre and buna kudula attached to the shell.
This will give them a fairly good indication of the size of the Wadi and from that an approximation of its rank. It should be noted that the term Wadi refers only to the undecorated finished cone shell. Decorations to the shell add nothing directly to its status and classification. Decorations using the small Kauri ovular costellata shells, tray beads, seeds, etc. are used in Vakuta merely to enhance the general appearance of the Wadi, and in many cases are used to trick young and inexperienced Kula men into thinking that they have quite a particularly fine Wadi, just because they want to decorate. Europeans are
for the
tourists.
Cool
a lot,
the
yes.
Tourists.
It is unusual to see high-ranking, is not unusual to see high-ranking Wadi or Vaigua, which are poorly decorated next to highly ranked, highly decorated, low-ranking valuables, as you can see in this slide. This shell here will be a higher ranking shell because you can see its age signs here on the vent striations. Now I don't know how those are formed. These shells here are apparently very old, collected in the 18th century, and they're still white. So whether it's because of the handling that they get these red striations, I don't know. But certainly the Vakuta say that the new ones are white and shiny like that. They have no age, they have no markings on their faces. But look at the decoration. This one's very, it's not overly decorated at all, this one's very highly decorated.
Is that a pear? Or is
no, that isn't a pear, it's just a
pear. They're both Peter.
Well, this Peter's the name of the person who got those.
Uh-huh.
They write the names in pencils just because they put them all in a big basket when they take them back to the village and then they distribute them later.
So they're going to erase them?
Yes, yes.
Right.
They used to do that even before they could write their name.
In woodlock they don't write their names.
Don't they do?
No.
But
it's all made in
woodlock. You see them occasionally coming through, written on.
Yes, but I was always informed those were the names of the articles.
Yeah, the name of the article,
yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I, yeah, for the Vaigua, on the mother of pearl shell, they write the name of the article on that. But they can't scratch the name on these. I don't know why they don't write the names of these, the Wadi on them. Because on the Vaigua they say they do write the names very often, and you look at this mother of pearl shell, it's got its name on it. But they also scratch in names of various owners on that. But not on the Wadi. And
well,
they do rub those names off as soon as they get moved on.
Peter Wan has some of the names of the Vaigua scratched
on the Wadi.
Yes,
yes.
Nice.
I have a picture at home of Uli Laba, one of the big ones.
Mm.
He has Uli Laba written across the top.
Mm.
I'll bring them in tomorrow.
Yeah.
Could you say something about the pink and thing, the blue thing, what is that?
Yes,
well,
all right.
That's for the
toilet. The ovular costellata are these little cowrie shells here. This would be plastic, mother's pearl, shells, any kind of shell. These are various seeds. You know those boats that they get, like wetsuits? They would make little balls of that and sew them all together and make that. So it's sort of an imitation boat-to-boat, I don't know, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the red things?
Hmm?
What about the red and flat things?
These ones here,
yeah.
That's plastic. These are tray beads.
Mm-hmm. And the small red thing lower there, also plastic.
Where?
This one here.
No, to the right. Behind another one, yeah. No. In the more.
The yellow and green.
There are two banana seeds and then, yeah, that one.
No, that looks like shells to me.
A shell?
Yeah, it looks like shells this close up.
Probably from Russell Island.
Yeah, they look like they look a bit like a nut.
Yes.
They are those muscle. Things to make noise, not to look like something, but to, when you wear them or carry them around, they tingle like the things of like tapping your line board or the things that hang off the fronts of canoes and things. That's the main object, is to make a noise.
One thing I looked at, the color symbolism, which I haven't been able to work out yet. I haven't had time to really this. Whenever you find this Wadi, you always, and before the decoration, you always get this red line here, which is along these kudula, which is the mouth teeth. And they have this thing about feeling that in their mouth being red.
Mm.
I think that's what's going on, but I'm not, I haven't looked
at it.
This is made of plastic, this one. But they do have red, they do dye red reed, and they make it all together. And we were talking.
Surely, in our masters, we just saw a mini Wadi that looked like that.
No,
the
problem is they're not colored, are they?
No. The Wadi,
the Maurya Kalinowskis period seem to be completely different from this. What they would do is they just, the kudula bit, this bit down here, they would decorate and they put some banana seeds decoration. They have long pandanus
windows
hanging down. And but what they did do, I noticed just the other day, is they do have the red thing between the shell and the decoration, which is very interesting. And the one that we were looking at the other day had cloth, red cloth between the decoration and the shell.
In 1551, my informant, well, I didn't see very many, but the best ones were much more like the one on the left, which you said. And they said, in effect, you know, this is the proper way to do it. All this stuff, this is just dim stuff, you know,
yeah.
Just prettying up, doesn't really mean a thing.
Mm-hmm. But the logo itself is important, isn't it? The logo, the shell, the towers, the logo are important, but not all the beam decor.
Yeah, these little ones. These little ones here. They're not important in terms of value and ranking. They're important in terms of enhancing the face of the shell. Also in doing all this elaborate beadwork.
But enhancing the face of the shell is an important in the process of making it into higher rank.
Yes, it is important, but not for classification purposes. It's important in terms of presentation. Like if a woman is dancing, she paints her face and so that she's presenting herself, that's what's important, but not in terms of ranking. If for the woman she'd be classified in terms of, you know, whether she could get access to good garden land, or she had access to particular people who would give her skirt material and stuff like that, or, you know, various other things. That would be her rank. But in terms of presentation it's different.
Of the show itself.
No. These little ones here.
Yeah, or the shells we were putting in before, they're called logo on Gawa, and they stress that, you know, that a shell has to have some logo before it is considered. They, in fact, they do that, they add things to it.
Yeah.
To more value.
Yeah. Well, they do say that low-ranking shells, when they come in, they haven't got these big shells that I named one of the Padula. They haven't got them, and as they move on, as they attain rank, they are attached on. And yes, when in one of the categories, the second category down from the high rank in the Wadi Buti category, is when it's very important to have this Wadi Doga attached to the side of the Wadi, because that indicates it's now reached this particular rank, and should have that many. If it hasn't already accumulated those, then it's not. So it's important in those rooms, otherwise I'm not aware of anything else.
Well, one thing that may make a difference is that normally people say that valuables become more famous than exchanging for more valuable valuables.
Mm-hmm.
And one way you can possibly do that is to have some kind of fancy decoration on it that will make it famous.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, here's a valuable near Briarwood that had 20 toilet pieces on it.
Mm-hmm.
And irrespective of its size, it was famous, and people talked a great deal about it because of all this money on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's what Gawans would do with shells too. They would add decor, and by this idea was to get a higher level value for it, and make it appear to be a higher level value.
I think there's a significant point there, because woodlock people denied that they could change value once they were put into circulation.
Well, that's what Gawans occasionally would say that too, and yet they would make them so doing it, you know.
Well, yeah, woodlock people did too. You know, a guy added the doorknob onto it.
They would say that they would take a ketong that was a low level valuable wasi level, and they'd say, look, we dress it up a bit. Your partner doesn't know, and you pass it off as a menomar, it's a little bit higher, and then you get a higher level valuable back for it. And then since it's a ketong, you pass it on, you get another higher level. And they say you can raise it up to the very highest.
Woodlark people accuse Gao people of doing.
Well, that's kind of what
so it's true. It's
true.
What kind of people did you live with?
The terminology for the body part of the Vaigul is structured quite differently from that of the Moari. This is not altogether surprising when the physical shapes of the two Vaiguls are compared. Whereas the Māori is referred to in terms of head or forehead, mouth, teeth. The terminology for Vaigua uses plant terminology with trunk, roots, and top growth. The Vaigua is considered to be the female partner of Kula.
Mm-hmm.
Next one.
Contrary to mouth.
The end of the Vaigua, which has attached a large cowrie shell or ovula ovum, is kobi'u'una, corresponding to the base or roots of the plant. This shell is also known as pwala, meaning male testicles. The end? Yeah, sorry. This one here. This is the end of the Tagala Dogi.
Can you clarify a point of terminology? You're reserving Vaigua for these things, which are Manoski Kosilala, but he used the term Vaigua as a box category.
Yes. In Mākuta, they don't use the words, very, very rarely you hear the word Sabala. And the only time I heard it was when I initiated that sort of word being used in the conversation. They use Vaigua, the Dobuns use Vaigua, and the Katawans use Vaigua for these. Yes, they don't use Sabala at all. The Dobun at the end refers to the top pliable part of the plant and can also be called Taigala or ear. Both the Dogana and Uluna shell ends are decorations and, like the Māori decorations, are not indices to classification, according to the Vākutans. What is important is the tapuana, or string of spondylous shells. Tapuana refers to the trunk or base of, or the whole length of a tree trunk. Yes.
It's this one, isn't it?
Yes, it's this. The whole string of shells is tapuana. That's the uluna and dogina. And when they hold these things, they say the uluna is supposed to go underneath the dogina end, because the uluna being the base of the tree is heavier than the dogina, which is the top part of the tree.
The same terms used in categorizing plots of magical stuff.
Mm.
And in Kula Canoes, Masawa.
Yes.
It is the size, shape, and color of these shells that are used to classify the nephilim. The hanging assemblages attached to either end of the tapuana are made up of various pieces of shell, tin, plastic, coins, and various other European innovations are inputted into society. And these contribute to the sounds of the buibui, which is what they call the hanging assemblages, and that is part of the sounds of success in Kula. When you walk through the village, these things just automatically jingle about, and people know all over the place that a value has been taken away. Somebody's won in the Kula. Okay, I'm just turning this off for a bit. Just the light. Okay. Oh, that's a bit.
Maybe the overhead light would be useful.
Thanks. The classification criteria from Māori have been listed earlier as size, circumference, and width. Generally, ranking increases with increasing dimension, but clearly the dimension of a conusmuth and kata shell are limited by its own growth limitations. Therefore, men cannot interfere significantly with the size of a shell, which is used as major categorizing criteria. However, movement does take place between categories as shells are cooled and acquire personal histories. Age is another important criteria in ranking Māori. It is usually indicated by color changes in the cone shell material. Conus shells tend to form red striations on the shell surface as it ages and is handled. These striations are called ureri. New, unstriated shells entering the ranking system are therefore placed in the lower classification categories. As they age and develop red striations in personal histories, they are revalued into the upper ranks, provided that their dimensions already equate with the high ranking criteria. Only a few men ever cool with the higher ranking shells. Now, if you could look at the table 1 on page 9, it lists the ranking criteria for the shells, and I'll just go through on the slide showing examples of various ranks. This particular shell, well, this shell it would be classed as Māori cow. It would be on the top, Buriwa, which is a very top ranking of the
whole category of Hawaii. If this one's name is Nanola, or Toyamaka Nanola.
Which is mentioned in the Argonauts.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So Melanos, you know, you've got it, you've got it in this one. How many, roughly, do you say? But not very many more. It's not very many.
Yeah, that's right. There's a fixed, or they perceive it as a fixed.
It's right. Yes.
I was told 10 to 12.
I was told about 20, and I have lists which I haven't fully counted yet. That must run up to about 20.
Mm.
Is that 20 in the class, or is it 20 in the?
That's the
when
top
I say individual name.
No.
Top class model.
Top class.
Something between 10 and 20 shells.
Right.
Of that
value. Of the area.
You see, and also they have categories. And they have also individual names for the high-ranking seals. But it seems that there are some individual names that there more than one seal have.
Yeah, that's true in Kula too.
Yeah.
Mm. Some people might ask, why, how do I know this is Nanola? I think in Malinowski he does say that Nanola, his Nanola, was found here in on an island, or very near an island, called Nanola, which is just south of Mula, near where I worked. And that it was picked up from this area, and they named it after this island. Well, the Vakutans told me the same thing about this shell. This shell was fished out of the water just near Nanola. It was lost to them for a very long time. Some European bought it, somebody on the boat, and he took it to Moresby, and then gradually brought it back to Dover. So one of the workers on Mula, plantation workers, saw this shell, and he knew that that was Nanola. He knew it was that. Was exactly what it was. He put in 100 kina, put it back to Kitala, and fed it into the system, and there it goes again.
but how did you know that there aren't more than one?
I don't know at all, but I mean, the Toyamaka Nanola is that's the name of that particular shell. It was the biggest shell in the whole area. Everybody was talking about it. The Dogoons all came up in mass in 7 boats just to see it.
I'm a sort of connoisseur expert, because after all, in the world of fine art, there are in many great pictures, there are several copies, and there are tremendous feuds as to which is the authentic one.
Yes,
I mean,
especially
to
the Rembrandts.
if this is a very well-known and precious seal, then why didn't they go to the big pains of decorating it with the European stuff and all this?
Oh, that doesn't matter at all. They have no idea that their sort of decorations are more aesthetic than ours.
I mean that they have certainly been decorating more than it was in Malinowski's time, I suppose.
Yes,
yeah.
In Malinowski's time I would say the decoration would be different, so they have, it's just like fashion.
There's a new fashion of decoration.
Would each
yes.
Change the decoration?
Yes, they could.
If this gets catty, then they will change because I mean, I have seen shells where these things break because they don't usually use fishing rod, they can't get it, and they redecorate, but they can't change this inner structure for the ranking of the shell. I mean, the rank indices to the shell. All they do is they put new stuff on here, but that. Again, I said it doesn't mean anything to them. What they're interested in is this, and how big that is, how wide that is, and how large that is.
And that's what makes it Waikau.
That's what makes Waikau. This stuff is just irrelevant as far as I'm concerned.
But how do they remember? I mean, couldn't all those things put on the characteristics to know the thing again? I mean, it's not very easy to...
Well, that is one of them, yes. There are certain characteristics they do put on shells which identifies it across the whole area. Like, when we were talking about one shell that I know, I had personal relationship with this shell. It's called Matsu Paisewa. Now, people would say, they would come and say, I hear you have Matsu Paisewa, and I say, yes. They say, describe it. And I say, well, it's a very large shell, and what is not a one account, turns out it's a poem, which is a different, that puts it in a rank. That it comes from the lagoon area of Kavataya, so it can never be one account, because this is a large enough But they'd say describe it, and I'd say, well, it has a coin right there in the middle of it. That's multiply stable. They would be okay, then you really do need multiply stable. Then they'd say, how on earth did you ever get multiply stable?
There's another thing about an article with spots, that 30 or 40 years of transactions.
So it,
where is it now?
It's probably in Dover now.
Fred?
There's another thing about an article the size, that 30 or 40 years of transactions. Like I know when this went into Dequoise, where it went from Dequoise, it went all the way around the range, it went up to Western Woodlock, it went all the way back to Wari War, I believe, then into Yemga, and she's got it now. Went to Yemga in 76. Yeah, early 76. And so she got it. No, that one.
This
no,
is
no.
Not
yes.
Circulation since Malinowski was there, those decorations will have had to have been renewed more than once, I should have thought. They simply won't last when they're being shunted around and handled a lot. The other question, have you any information as to when that particular shell was in Lakuta previously? Was it this its first turning up since Malinowski, or had it been there?
The cater for that particular shell has made it. Has gone, I don't want to say going around the ring because that is misleading, I think. But it has made it started in Kitaba and it's gone around through Kitaba or Rakuta, I would say, three times. When I photographed this, it had been there, this was the third trip to Rakuta area.
That would be including Malinowski.
No, that is after, that was after it was
rebought.
Presumably the very valuable one, the last, because of the advertisement, it moves much faster than the other one.
They move much slower, yes. This man will not let go of that shell until he gets the shell with the necklace he wants, the sonar. Mm-hmm. Is their marriage. And this man who's got it is a very young man, as you'll see in another slide, he's wearing it. And by rights, he shouldn't have that show because he's much too young to have it. But he's got it because his uncle died who was in line for it. So that's why he's got the show. And he's the other show, when I was there, the Dublins came up in Basi, this show, which I'll get on in my next paper. What he did is they came up and they give this necklace to the man who owns that, trying to put him in the deck to give that show to him. And that necklace was Kibwaku.
Could you elaborate on this, the necklaces and armchairs being married?
Pardon? It was married.
I mean, they seem to be associated. You say they're married.
Yes, they say that they're married. They have been cooled together and they have been going around and meeting three times.
In Lakuta.
Once that ends, it's a divorce and it goes on
in
the
in Lakuta.
So they can only meet in Lakuta. They can't meet anywhere else.
No.
No, well, this they can, you see, because that shows how slowly this goes. This man won't give up that shell when he gets the sonar because he's afraid that he'll lose the whole shell if he gives that shell up.
To the particular necklace in Lakuta. This would mean that all these senior arm shells had a spouse in every port.
No.
Not necessarily, because I mean this case is different because he's a young man who's afraid to give it up. A more secure man in Kula would probably let it go, knowing that Kasana would eventually make it to him, but not only would already gone. But this man's afraid to. If he doesn't hold on to that and he listens to these Dabun's line tunes saying that they're going to give him the Samai whenever he gets there, then he will have lost, because they'll just laugh at him and say, you know, you're a stupid man, you gave up.
Is that his Ketum then, is it?
Hmm?
Is that his Ketum?
No, that's not Ketum, it's Keda, which is, there's a difficulty there.
Is it called
a
bird
Keda?
No, that's somebody else's Ketum. It's been transferred at least once.
You know, the thing that makes it so rare is that
structure of the shell, I think.
Yeah. I think so.
Yes. Something is probably diffusing in from the surface along
the
line.
I think the surface gets more translucent through time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the inner structure of it.
The spots on the surface they scrape off or defect in rows, like that.
Right.
Yeah. It may be the reappearance of what's underneath there.
Yeah.
But
if they
could
make that in technology, then they would do that effect in order to increase the joint of the shell. Which appears to be this sort of thing with certain.
Yes, I saw one very, very old shell. It was almost brown because it was so old, but it still had that sort of very shiny pattern. And the shell had broken, and what they had done, they tried to put it back together, and they put wires to it to sort of sew it together. looked like a garden, it was very fragile.
Surely we've dug up some like that that have been repaired from Milo. And they're 2,000 years old. And they're identical in form to the ones you're illustrating now. So I mean, I don't know what sort of context they're passing around them, but these things are 2,000 years old.
The only thing that the British Museum was able to buy and paid $14,000 for it was a small broken ivory. And the reason they were able to get it, somebody said it looked fishy and the other people thought it was a fake. And but the British Museum had the other half of the ivory and so it's now put together again. These are over 2,000 years old.
Oh, we're not going to find that.
Jeff, have the archaeologists dated any shell earlier than that, or are those the earliest dates?
Those are the earliest I know of.
Yeah.
And well, those are the earliest dates for the whole of Papua anyway. So they must be the earliest.
Yeah.
I was trying to find Wadi Bushu. It's got a very wide kudula, say. It can accommodate four little kudula. So this shell will eventually get probably another shell up on top there. Now at the moment it's only got two. And we'll probably get a third, which we'll put it into the Wadi Town Grass. Okay.
Does that have
so
a name?
Who decided?
There's the class below the Wadi Town.
Yes, just below. Now this is the third, this is the middle ranking class, called Wadi Gagheda. And in this class, this is a fairly new shell, this one. It's a white, it's very polished, it's got lovely decorations. It's fairly large shell, it's got its three Wadi Dogo, although they will probably consider that it was too soon for that. I mean, I'm just going on conjecture there. If it's got four Wadi Dogo across the bottom of it. This one has not got a name, nor has it got any accredited history yet.
Any reason for the Gita Gita part referring to biting or
the semantic reference there, or the linguistic reference there, is that Gita Gita means biting pain or fright. And what they say is one Gita Gita, we can throw it out and we're not afraid to throw it out because it would bite. A Basi, it would bite a Baigua. We're not going to worry about that at all because it's always going to bite its mate, whatever. They don't worry about those ones because they're fairly good ones. And most people can pull them with this rank. It's the next two up that we just saw that you can't. It's very difficult to get into that rank. Once you get into those ranks, you're always in it. You never ever leave it.
But how, the process of putting a thing into a higher rank, who in fact does it?
Well, I'm describing a very sort of ideal type system with, a very neat little categories. But in fact, I mean, what you get from that last one I just showed you, the Wadi Bushu, the person who owned that shell tried to pass it off as a Wadi Pau, and a very amazing Wadi Pau. And when the Dogons came, that particular shell, the last one I showed you, was one that I went to the top and brought back. And when the Doguns came, this is for my father, and when the Doguns came, they saw the shell, and my father was saying, well, it's a Wadi Cow, and, it's really good, this is your cave, you take it, and you bring it back, it's really nice. And later, the Doguns said, Sasu, he's lying, it's not really Wadi. It's Wadi Butu, but I mean, it was a big shell, they were quite pleased to have it. So, I mean, there's lots of shades of grey, it's not as black and white as I'm presenting. Trying to give an idea of what is happening. Okay, let's see.
Could I ask about you mentioned the rainbow element there. is the keel of the canoe ever thought of as the perfect keel though as a rainbow? I'm thinking of these shapes, these curved shapes. And
here.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that's also linked up with the shape of the arm shell that part of it is called by rainbow, right?
Yes, this.
It's the bone.
I have not investigated that. No, they never wanted that to rainbow. There's no symbolism, but that they call one is called the water, and it means we're just getting into sort of
last one.
These ones.
Yes.
a nice noise, you know, playing together in the water. And that's what, I mean, there's a lot of civil logic that isn't going there, but I haven't been able to analyze it, I haven't had time, but, you know, that's something that's really, I think it's important to be able to be here. These are the ones that knock together make this sort of horrible wintertime noise, and that in case, you know, when people carry it off, you can really particularly know that somebody has succeeded.
In terms of the chimes, let me just mention that traditionally, if you had betel nut trees or coconut trees that were really given, had already been given to a chief, but they were in your village, and you put a mat around to prevent anyone from climbing it, you also hung the Buna shells down, and because it was important for the clinging, the tinkling noise would remind everyone that this was a chief's tree.
And
so
it's a chief's privilege to take your lime bullet, which is sticking
to
the rabbit.
So again,
that sets you out as a man of distinction.
Right. Look at
no
me.
Small.
Yeah. All right, this is Komori Waya, which is the fourth ranking in the hierarchy, second to the bottom. And it's a small shell, looky white. It may get to the next ranking, that might eventually make the morning Buddha, but it would never make the morning cow class, because it's just the Wado is just, it's a very small shell. The reason it would make the Wado Buddha possibly doesn't get traded out and get lost off in the Normandy somewhere, then if it gets restorations, then they would classify it as being an old shell. And they would acquire a name. This class has no name, Paul has no history, very small. And this is the Gibwa. Gibwa, very small shell. Notice how musky it is and nasty. They don't even bother polishing one up, nor do they bother to polish it and decorate it, or clean up its unikulu at all. It has no one to go. This is very small. It would never go on one's hand. Also, I might mention that Gibwa, in Vakudin, it means the little tiny hole on top of the coconut, they scoop out, that's Gibwa Gibwa, which is very tiny indeed, barely stuck out with the coconut, walked again to have a nice drink. Also, they use Gibwa Gibwa in Kula for joking. Say one man was given a mwadi from a Kitaban, and the man would say, oh, he's only given me Gibwa Gibwa, this is, you know, a little rubbish, even though it might be a mwadi he gave it, you know, it might be one of the high rank, not the high rank, so they, or people would say, oh, you've only got a Gibwa Gibwa, you're a low ranking, you can't possibly, you know, how are you making me come to that, you have to get anything with it, you're going to throw it out and never see it again, you never keep it cool going. So it's used as a derogatory term as well. Well, I wanted to say something about the Bible of classification time.
Okay.
Both Mwadi and Baigua are ranked according to a classification system using the criteria age, history, color, and spawnless disc size, or chama, whatever. Unlike the Mwadi, the age of spawnless shell cannot be determined by color because this is a permanent, natural feature of the shell and does not change with age and handling. Spawnless shell shows a range of shades varying between a browny red to a light pinkish red, according to the characteristics of individual shells. Nevertheless, classification is determined by color in that a salmon pink would be more highly valued than a browny red. Age is determined by the shape of the shell string. A high-ranking shell string should look fine and thin like a fishing line and feel smooth as oil because it is old and worn smooth with handling and grinding. A young Baigua is unlikely to have achieved the optimum shape because the shell string is processed through a number of stages of grinding and polishing, corresponding to the number of its owners. It takes a good deal of grinding and polishing over a period of time for the shells to achieve the shape appropriate for a high-ranking Baigua. A further ranking criteria is related to the shells of each shell disc on the string. They should not be thick, nor should there be any chips in the disc. Again, it is possible to influence the disc shape by many hours of grinding. Grinding and polishing may be carried out by owners who wish to raise the Baigua to high rank and who have the time and equipment necessary for such work. Only a few men can ever cool it with these Baigua. And there's just two slides off this. This is a man who owns an Anola. There's Ranola, and he's wearing Kabwaku, which is the shawl I said earlier came up in Basi Ranola. Now this man will have to hurry up and find another shell Kamali to give for that, otherwise he'll lose his Ranola. But I'll go into that later in the paper. This is Badi, the highest ranking of the five who are ranked classification. And the top one you see is very, very thin. And that is the required color, sort of a very sort of salmon-y pink, I suppose is the best color you could describe. And it's not overly red, it hasn't got any browns in it. It's just a perfect redness. Rather like what you see on, you know, when people chew you, that's the sort of thing they like. Then these are anything at all.